Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, April 24th, 2020. Producing from his home studio in Connecticut, Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney. I'm working from my home studio just north of New York City. We'll continue General Manager Week today. And former Dodger General Manager Ned Coletti will tell you how incredibly close he came to landing C.C. Sabathia before the 2008 trade deadline, a deal that might have changed baseball history. And he has a remarkable story about a conversation between Yasiel Puig and Kobe Bryant. Before that, a couple of news and notes. Hall of Fame broadcaster Vin Scully is in the hospital after a fall at home. The Dodgers announced that Scully, who's 92, fell at his Los Angeles area home Tuesday, but is resting comfortably. Scully joked in the Dodgers tweet that he, quote, won't be doing any more headfirst sliding. I never liked it. So our best wishes go out to our friend Vin Scully. Select games from the final 10 days of the MLB The Show Players League, including its playoff tournament, are being broadcast on ESPN, ESPN2, FS1, and MLB Network. And that started last night. Based on the social media I see, sounds like Joey Gallo of the Rangers is an absolute beast in this competition. Now, before we get to Ned Coletti and to Todd Radom, one last reminder this week to tune in to The Last Dance, Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. It's been great so far, and word is it only gets better as the series continues. And listen to the wrap-up podcast hosted by Jalen and Jacoby immediately following the broadcast, presented by State Farm and AT&T. Available wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz, Draft Artist. He's seen on ball fields all across America, all across the world, most of the time, not right now. So you can go to his website at toddradom.com. Todd, how you doing this week?
I'm doing well, Buster. How are you? Another week.
I'm doing okay. I'm feeling better because I got a little baseball experience last night. I participated in this Milwaukee Brewers Zoom event where it was hosted by their play-by-play man, Brian Anderson, who always does such a great job, their general manager, David Stearns, Brandon Woodruff, of course, their top young pitcher, and Hall of Famer Robin Yount. And this was their way to connect with fans. And I got to tell you, they did a great job with that. I thought it was a lot of fun. The highlight for me, and maybe because, you know, I live in the general manager world in terms of my conversations, was to learn that David Stearns had cut his own hair. and it looked like something like Demi Moore had done in that movie when she became the special service. She was in the special services. I'm imagining that's how David Stearns cut his own hair.
Well, listen, we're all going to be there pretty soon, I suspect, Buster. But I love, absolutely love the idea of this kind of thing. On my side of the business, basically, you know, engaging fans is what we're trying to do. We're trying to reach out aesthetically or via social media or marketing, and doing this kind of a thing in a really, a direct way. I'm kind of at a loss for words, but again, I think it's incredibly engaging, really inventive. And these are times when we have opportunities here. It's not a great situation for anyone. I mean, when you think about big picture, that's a whole different story, but I love the idea of it. Absolutely love it.
Yeah. Robin Yount was really funny. He was showing different parts of his office where his MVP awards were hung in his office. Brandon Woodruff, had some funny stories about when he hit the playoff home run off Clayton Kershaw. And I had never heard this story. And David Stearns said he'd never heard the story that, you know, he's excited. He comes back to the dugout and he's going through the celebration line. And Curtis Granderson, who the Brewers had picked up to sort of be the veteran presence down the stretch, stops him at the end of the line and said, look, you just hit a big home run, but you got to go out and pitch the next half inning. So you need to stop being excited and get back in the clubhouse and calm yourself down. And it was, and like David Stearns had never heard that story. He's like, I love that story. That's exactly why we got him, was to do things like that. And Todd, you'll be shocked that the event was sponsored by Miller Beer.
Oh, it's shocking. It's shocking, Buster. I mean, geez, when we get around with our ballpark talk to Milwaukee, that could be the beer part could be a whole chapter. And they are the Brewers, of course, but gotta love it. And I actually love the diversity of people involved in this conversation, front office, player, media, somebody like you, a Hall of Famer like Robin Yount. What a terrific idea. We need more of it. We need more of something like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was fun. And you kind of touched on how do you like my transition skills? Talking about Miller Beer, we're going to be talking about Coors Field in Colorado.
It's perfect. It's absolutely perfect.
This week's ballpark talk about Coors Field. Whenever I go there, I mean, my first thing is I love looking at the Rocky Mountains from high on up in the ballpark. And the second thing is it always jumps out at me because I like purple is as a colorblind person is one of my most difficult colors. So I don't really appreciate that as much as the vast expanse of that outfield, which is so much bigger than any other outfield. When you just look out at the field and, you know, it's the bane of pitchers everywhere. What jumps out at you about Coors Field?
I mean, you hit on a couple of things. Number one, the first thing, I took some notes here. It is huge. The ballpark is huge. It was really built at a time, Buster. You know, we're used to seeing small capacity ballparks. Every place is being clawed back at as far as the amount of seating is concerned. When they built Coors Field, they're coming out of Mile High Stadium, which was just gigantic. So, I mean, the footprint of the place is just enormous. All of those bricks, the mountains, the view from the first base side, especially high up. What do we keep coming back to with this conversation? A defined sense of place.
Yes.
Coors Field has this really defined sense of place. I love the neighborhood that it's in. The fact that you can glance over at one side and see this vibrant streetscape. And you look over at the other side from up high, and there are those beautiful mountains. It couldn't be anyone else or any place else. The amount of bricks is just staggering, right? Somewhere.
And I love that. Personally, I love the bricks.
Yeah. I mean, it looks organic. It looks like it looks like Coors Field. I've been out there a long time. But the spectacular views, the defined sense of place. I love that row of purple seats exactly 1 mile up in the upper deck, right?
I never noticed them. I got to be honest.
Well, sorry, Buster.
I didn't even know
about it, if nothing else.
Seriously, if I were to rank the trouble colors for me, green would be number one and purple would be number two. Like, I can't distinguish between purple and blue.
Wow. One of these there's probably some exhibition game, a spring training game between the Rockies and the Athletics where they're wearing their BP jerseys that would absolutely drive you crazy. But I understand. But Coors Field has aged really well. You know, I remember when it came online, and again, everything spins off of Camden Yards at that time. This has aged really well. Do you have any memories of Mile High Stadium, Buster?
Oh yeah, I was just gonna say. You talk about it was most famous for being the home of the Denver Broncos, and when you watched a baseball game in Mile High Stadium, you really felt like, yeah, this is them playing baseball in a football stadium.
Yeah,
because the look of it and where the stands were and the shape of it, I'm glad they built Coors Field. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, you think about it, and we'll get around to Oakland at some point in this conversation. All of that fallow ground. And I had posted a picture a couple of weeks ago on Twitter of a game in Cincinnati in April of 1987. And the hash marks, the Bengals field was very, very apparent at Riverfront. Not good optics. And I'm all about optics, as you know.
Exactly. All right, let's get to this week's quiz.
All right, guys, here we go. The Milwaukee Brewers, speaking of the Brewers, have reverted back to their ball in glove look for 2020, the ball in glove logo. Here's this week's question. Who designed the original logo back in 1978? Was it A, Brewers general manager Harry Dalton? Was it B, a college student at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire? Was it C, Bud Selig's wife? Or is it D, the in-house art department at the Schlitz Brewing Company? Original designer of the Brewers' iconic ball and glove, Harry Dalton, a college student, Bud Selig's wife, or the in-house art department at Schlitz, speaking of beer?
Taylor, what do you got?
I'm thinking B or D. I'm going to go B because I feel like in the 60s, like name and logo kind of campaigns amongst fans was pretty popular. So I'll go B with the college student.
I'm going to go B as well, Todd.
You're both brilliant because that's the deal. A guy named Tom Mundell, and he created this much beloved logo that continues to resonate years and years after it first launched. good job, guys. You are sharp.
Yeah, and Brian Anderson last night was wearing a cool sweatshirt. I was kind of jealous. I'm like, I got to find a way to get that sweatshirt. It had that had that look last night with a hood on the back. So that was cool, and I'm glad we finally got one right. I'd been on a losing streak in recent weeks. Before you go, we're about ready to talk to Ned Colletti, the former general manager of the Dodgers, and I intend to ask him about the Dodgers' dealings in the summer of 2008. They wind up landing Manny Ramirez, and you know, as I'm going to ask him, boy, his last months with the Red Sox, in the time that I've covered baseball, that was one of the ugliest times of in terms of a player's conduct that I've ever seen. Manny Ramirez, no doubt, one of the best right-handed hitters of all time. When you talk to his peers, they thought he had a special insight into hitting. You know, he worked like crazy at it. Probably the best breaking ball hitter of his generation. But those last 4 months with the Red Sox, it was so bad where you're literally questioning from at bat to at bat whether or not he was intentionally trying to get himself traded. What do you remember about that as a Red Sox fan?
Yeah, you're totally right, Buster. And I think context is important. Red Sox finally break through, win a World Series in 2004, first time since 1918, as we all know. And then they win this, I don't know, kind of great dessert of a World Series in 2007. It was very different from 04. So in the spring of 08, you got all these great feelings surrounding the ball club. They're kind of playing with house money to some degree. It's a great time to be a Red Sox fan. And that was really disheartening. It was, to me, like watching this couple that you've known for years and their marriage has disintegrated and somehow you know it's going to end, and you just want it to end sooner rather than later. It was really rough to watch.
It was really rough to watch, for sure. And as I say, it was. If I were to rank the worst things I've seen in baseball in terms of player conduct, that would probably be number one. And before you leave, I have to inform you that the movie I referred to with Demi Moore is G.I. Jane. All right, Todd, thanks for doing this. Thanks for the quiz.
All right, guys, great talk with you. Thank you.
Ned Colletti was a general manager for the Los Angeles Dodgers for 9 years after working as the assistant general manager for the San Francisco Giants. He's an analyst on the Dodgers pre- and post-game show, and he's now a scout for the San Jose Sharks, and he teaches at Pepperdine. Besides that, you got nothing going, Ned.
Exactly, Buster. Good to hear your voice, my friend.
Good to talk with you, too, and thanks for taking the time to be part of General Managers Week and distract us from what's going on and join us for some storytelling. And, you know, the question I've had fun with this week, and, you know, Sandy Alderson and J.P. Ricciardi, Doug Melvin, the question that I've been asking them, it's got some interesting responses, is what's the biggest deal that you were involved, the conversations you were involved in that didn't go down?
Well, it's funny you mentioned Doug Melvin, because he was the beneficiary of the biggest deal I had on the table that didn't go down. And it was end of the first week. It was, I think, maybe 4th of July weekend in 08. And the Dodgers, we had a good team, but we were banged up by injury. And I was trying to get from Cleveland CC Sabathia. And I had talks with Mark Shapiro and also with Chris, and many talks with Chris. And we got to the 4th of July weekend. And the team was in San Francisco. Dodgers were in San Francisco. It was a Saturday. I had about an 8-player deal that I thought we could walk to the end. It may have taken one more player from our end, but Chris at least led me to believe that we had a legitimate chance to get CC Sabathia, who was going to be a free agent after that season. And we were going to get CC Sabathia. We were going to get Casey Blake to play third base because Nomar Garciaparra had been out. We were going to get Jamie Carroll, who could play all over the infield, as you recall, to play shortstop because Rafael Furcal had been out. And we were about a 500 club as we got into July. And we got to the point where I talked to Joe Torre, who was our manager. I went down to see him early in the day, and I said, you know, we've got our owner, Frank McCourt, coming in tonight, and we got to see if we can convince him to give us the blessing to do this deal. And he said, you know, run it past me again. So he says, we're going to trade 5 prospects, one of which was Carlos Santana, who turned out to be a very good player. The other 4 were guys that they had a minute in the big leagues, but we didn't really think that they were going to be able to play in L.A. L.A. is a different market. It's different than New York and different than Boston and Philly and Chicago, but it's got its own uniqueness to it. and we had prospects that we thought probably get to the big leagues, but are they going to be stars in Los Angeles? No. And we also had a young catcher named Russell Martin, who was a two-time All-Star by that time. So we felt that we could afford to trade Carlos Santana if we were going to get Sabathia, Casey Blake, and Jamie Carroll. So we walked a walk down to the end, and I went down to the manager's office and talked to Joe, and Joe was excited about it. And everybody was kind of fired up that had the inkling of what we were thinking about. And we met that night. I think we maybe had a 6 o'clock game in San Francisco on that Saturday, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, a little bit early start. And so Joe and I met with Frank, and I ran the deal past him, and also the financial considerations of it. And, you know, he was concerned about giving up 5 prospects, and he vetoed the deal. He wouldn't let us do it. And I remember going upstairs. I remember because it would have changed our club. That year, we did go to the NLCS. And some things that happened after that, we acquired Casey Blake about 10 days later in a smaller deal. Did cost us Carlos Santana because Cleveland knew we would put him in a deal. So it did cost us Carlos, and Cleveland paid the entire salary of Casey Blake. A couple of weeks later, we got Manny Ramirez from the Red Sox. The Red Sox paid all of the Ramirez contract. We got into August then, because that happened July 31. We got into August, and my dear friend, I'm sure a dear friend of yours is now gone, Kevin Towers, I twisted his arm, which was really what it was, to have him trade me Maddox. And it was the second time we were able to acquire Greg. So we made all those deals in a very short period of time and got to the LCS. But having CC Sabathia at the top of our rotation, which was a good rotation, Derek Lowe was our ace, and Brad Penny was on that club. You know, we had some pitching, but when you add somebody like CeCe, and Doug did, and I think he was 11-2 or something like that, a phenomenal last couple months before he hit free agency and went to the Yankees. But that's the biggest one that got away, because I think it would have changed our course. It would have changed our entire rotation, and it would have changed our infield too, because our guys played hard, and they made it through it, and Furcal came back at the very end of the season. But you get a chance to add Casey Blake, who we did, who was a great leader, and Jamie Carroll, who, if Furcal had come back earlier, he had back surgery the first part of July that year. Had he come back earlier, you still got Jamie, who can play every infield position pretty much but first base and a little bit of outfield. Would have changed our dynamic completely. And then the twist to it is that when we acquired Manny Ramirez on the 31st of July, who probably had as good a stretch run as CeCe had, Manny offensively, I think he had 17 homers, 53 RBIs, hit almost 400. The deal that we made with Boston for those two players, we sent through Pittsburgh. It was a three-way deal, as you recall, that Jason yep. Bay went up to the Red Sox. Those two players were not involved in the Cleveland deal. So we could have made both deals.
Wow. And
so we could have had CeCe, Casey Blake, Jamie Carroll, and Manny. And then later on, Greg, because Greg, that deal was unaffected by anything we had done previously. So I think it's the one that when you say, you know, what's the one that got away? It's clear to me the one that got away.
So just to be clear, Ned, so you had it, you know, it was your deal to make if you said yes, if you got approval for the deal.
I had thought, and I had known Chris for a long time at that point. And, you know, you go back and forth, and Chris is a really good negotiator. And you go back and forth and back and forth. And I remember being up in my suite in San Francisco, and Scott Akasaki, our traveling secretary, came by, and he heard, I opened the door for him, I was on the phone with Chris, and I was walking through the dynamic of it. And do I know if Chris and Cleveland would have made the deal for the 5 people that I was offering? I can't answer that. Chris could. But I do know that we were at least walking the walk and getting close. And when I called Chris back, it was about, I mentioned that early game because I remember walking out of the clubhouse or walking out of the press box, maybe in the second inning, and going to find a quiet place on the press level at AT&T Park, it was called then, to find a quiet place where I could have this conversation with Chris that I wouldn't be interrupted and nobody would overhear it. And I remember in the conversation with him, and my impression at least, that he was disappointed we couldn't do this. It was about a $4 to $5 million take back on salary. And you know, I tried a couple other things, and Frank had given me a couple other ideas if I would include a certain player or two going back from our side. to kind of even out the money, but that would have, we would have been robbing Peter to pay Paul, as they say. So I don't know if we had a deal, if it was going to be accepted by Chris or not. And he and I have talked many times since, but I didn't necessarily want to know the answer to that. You know, I'd rather just leave it like, who knows, yeah. You know?
Well, and the fact that in the end, he wound up getting Carlos Santana probably tells you that that was the anchor he wanted in the deal.
No doubt. And when I went back to him on Casey Blake, because I really needed a third, I needed somebody on the left side of the infield. I was desperate for it. We were playing young players. We were playing guys that could give you a good game once a week. But, you know, the big leagues is 7 days. And the big league players can give you 6 out of 7. They're going to give you great quality. And when I went back to him on Casey Blake, I couldn't take on any money. There were deals I made, that deal, the Manny Ramirez deal. Boston paid $7+ million to us to take Manny. Kevin paid $2+ million for us to take Greg in the middle of August. We weren't in a position to take on any finances. So when I called him back on Casey, and he knew why the first deal had collapsed, he said, look, you know, we'll help you with the salary for Casey, but it's going to take the guy we really want out of this deal, which is Carlos Santana. So that's how it went.
When I talked to Doug Melvin and interviewed him, and we talked about CC's great run at the end of that year, he said it was the most unselfish thing that he's seen in baseball, the way that CC devoted himself to the Brewers and helped him. It must have made you gnash your teeth to watch that down the stretch. Not only how great CC was, but how invested he was.
He pitched on short rest. You know, he was 11-2 for the last 2 months of the season. I mean, he was the best pitcher in the National League. And I had known him. I was in San Francisco when he was going to high school up in Vallejo. And so I'd seen him play as a high school player. I knew him, and I knew the kind of quality and character he was. In fact, I tried to sign him as a free agent a few months after that. But as I saw this unfold, and we, you know, we made a run, and we got through the Cubs, who had the best record in baseball that year, in the division series, in a 3-game sweep, and we got to Philly, who ended up beating us. You know, we had a good team, and we were getting better. But to add somebody like that, not as you say, not just 11-2, but the leadership that he brought to that staff and to the New York staffs after that, it was tough to watch. It was tough to watch. But I've learned in the game after almost 40 years, you know, you worry about what you can control and what you can change. The other stuff, you know, you just got to – it'll drive yourself crazy thinking about, well, if only. The two biggest words in sport, if only, you know.
Well, I think I'm going to get Chris Antonetti on at some point in the next few weeks. And if I do, I'll ask him that question. But I don't know if you want to know the answer.
Send me the answer. But tell him to lie about it.
There you go. You mentioned about trading for Manny Ramirez. I'm curious because you've been in baseball your whole life. You know, you've always done your work with integrity. And I was, you know, curious because you saw how, you know, he conducted himself to force his way out of Boston.
Yep.
When you traded for him, were there reservations in your mind, or was it, did you just think it was a purely for Manny, a financial situation going on, and once he got reset with you, he'd be good to go?
Well, I didn't know Manny, but the night of the deadline, and I'll give you just a touch of background into that too. Theo had come to me maybe the winter before and just kind of was kicking the tires on my interest in Manny. But it was what I thought Theo was really doing. He was really lining up how I was going to evaluate our young players, our Russell Martins, our Matt Kemps, our Loney's, guys like that. So I didn't really think it was a real exercise. And then he called me about Andy LaRoche in early July. And then he called me about Andy LaRoche again later in July. And on the 30th of July, he calls me one more time on Andy LaRoche. And I wasn't, you know, I would have moved Andy LaRoche, which I did the next day, but I needed more than who he was offering me. And as I'm watching the MLB network or some, probably the network, and on the bottom line, they have the scroll that says Red Sox about to trade Manny Ramirez, who, as you say, had been, you know, really messing up the club there, to Florida. Jason Bay going from Pittsburgh to Boston, and in Florida giving prospects to Pittsburgh and the Red Sox giving prospects to Pittsburgh. And I congratulated Theo on being able to make that move. I've known Theo since his days working for Kevin in San Diego, and I could tell by his voice he wasn't sure it was going to happen. And so at the end of the game, I went down and I talked to Joe. And I had the Maddox thing working, but I knew that was going to take some time because, again, we weren't taking back any salary. And as Kevin Towers told me that night, he said, so let me get this right. He said, we've been friends for 25 years, but you, the big bad Dodgers, want the little Padres to pay for you to take a Hall of Fame pitcher. I says, we're friends, right? He says, yeah. I says, good. You got that exactly right. He said, I can't do that today. And so I went down to tell Joe that. And I says, I got one more thing for you, Joe. I said, I'm not sure this is going to happen. I just got an inclination, though, that, you know, there might be a 10% chance it could happen. What would you think about adding Manny to this group? And he looked at me and he says, you're kidding me, right? And I said, no. He says, this guy might be the best right-handed hitter I've seen in years. And, you know, he managed against some Yankees, Red Sox for a decade and managed him in the All-Star game. So he kind of knew the personality a little bit. And he said, boy, you know, if you can get him, get him. We'll figure it out. So the next day, early in the morning, right before 5 in the morning, I get a call from Theo. Give me a shout. So I call him back, and he says, hey, Manny's agreed to go to you guys because he had a no trade, or 5 and 10, had one or the other. And to do that, he had waived the Red Sox, I think, held 2 club options on him for 9 and 10.
Yep.
And a player is always going to get something for waiving the right to not be traded. And the deal was that they were going to forego those 2 years. So he was going to be a free agent. So to answer your question, long roundabout way, but to answer your question, Manny Ramirez going to be a free agent now in 2 months, not going to be a free agent without a trade. To be traded, he's going to become a free agent. He's going to play on one of the biggest stages in professional sports on an iconic team franchise. I thought he would be on his best behavior. And I thought that he would be going for the lot, you know, going to win the lotto in the offseason. Plus he had Scott Boras representing him. And I've known Scott since Greg Maddox had about 2 or 3 years of major league service. So Scott and I have gone back 20-25 years. And, you know, knowing Scott, you know, knowing that, you know, and Scott lives in that region, you know, he was gonna not let anything bad happen to Manny. He was gonna keep Manny focused on playing and focused on being as good as he could be. And he came into the clubhouse, and we had a little bit of dysfunction the year before in 07. A lot of younger players, a lot of older players didn't get along. Had Nomar and Jeff Kent and Louis Gonzalez, guys like that, and then the young guys like Kemp and Martin and guys. There was a little bit of friction there. Manny went around locker by locker, introduced himself, and galvanized that club. Mm-hmm. He did it. He galvanized it, but of course he knew he was looking for a payday too. But he went off and he had 17, I think, and drove in over 50. I think he drove in a run a game for the last 2 months of the season, was great in the postseason, taught our guys how to win. Our guys had never really won before. Taught our guys how to win and really was an excellent, excellent player for us. Of course, the next year we signed him for 2 years. He tests positive in May. So obviously a different change in course there. But it was interesting because sometimes deals take months to consummate. That one took from about 6 in the morning until 1 in the afternoon Pacific when the deadline hit. We made the 3-team deal, and Boston paid us to take Manny, and Manny went off. But 3 weeks earlier, you could have had CeCe and Casey, who we did get, and Jamie Carroll besides Manny.
Wow, that would have been incredible. I was going to ask you about Clayton Kershaw and a couple other things. But first, when you get word about Manny's suspension, what do you remember about hearing that? Because that was,
oh, goodness.
At the time,
you know,
it happened, a huge story.
We had set a record, I think, for most consecutive home wins to start a season. I think it would maybe been 12 or 13. And we were playing Washington at Dodger Stadium. And we had a big lead in the game. And Manny came out of the game in the 7th or 8th inning. And typically, some days I'll go downstairs and visit the manager after the game. Sometimes I won't. I went down there that night to see Joe and to see how to, you know, talk with the training staff to see how everybody's doing. And, it came around to Manny. And I said, yeah, so Manny, you got Manny out early today. He goes, Manny kind of asked out early. And when the game was over, he wasn't here. And we didn't think too much of it. And I got home that night, and Frank called me, and he says, you know, are you sitting down? He says, I got bad news. And this is probably midnight. And wow. He says they're going to announce tomorrow that Manny's tested positive and he's going to be out till July. And I was stunned. And we got Joe on a conference call and I explained it to Joe. We were all taken aback. And then Manny disappeared. The team didn't see Manny until the team played in Florida. And we tried to continually get him to meet with the team, to, you know, if he was willing to apologize or whatever he wanted to do, at least show his face to the team. And it took him a while. I think he was embarrassed. I don't want to speak for Manny, but I think that, you know, I know it took him a while. I think we were in Florida when he did come to the team hotel and came up a side entrance and met with the guys for a couple minutes and then left. But it was a shock to the system. But that team, again, and I had good players on that team. I had guys that had great leadership qualities, the Osmuses, the Lorettas, guys like that. And we played tremendous in his absence. I'm not telling you we didn't miss him because obviously he was a linchpin to the lineup. But that team played better than the 08 team. And that team also went to the LCS back-to-back years against Philly. But the team kind of rallied around it. I had the style. I would speak to the team as a group for probably no more than 5 minutes the day everybody shows up in spring training, pitchers, catchers, and position players. And I would speak to the team at the end of the season. I'd have meetings weekly with individual players or groups of players or things like that. But as far as a group meeting, I wasn't somebody that called meetings in the middle of the season as a GM. I left that to the manager, coaching staff, players. That's their room. That's their responsibility in my belief system. But the day that Manny tested positive, you know, I had a rare team meeting first week of May 2009 and said, hey, you guys have all heard of the news, you know, but that doesn't mean we stop. And you know, we got to pick it up. We got to go. And everybody did.
Yeah, Manny's reaction was like what you read about Melky Cabrera when he was with the Giants. He wanted to get out before, you know, seeing other players. All right. So I want to hear about the first time you laid eyes on Clayton Kershaw.
It was the start before the draft, I think, in 06. And he faced 15 hitters and struck out 15 hitters. And I thought, oh, boy, you know, I'm glad I saw him really good, but I wish I didn't see him that good. You know, and we caught a break because the year before I got there. That was my first year there. Hochaver did not sign with the Dodgers, and he ended up being the number one pick in the nation that year, the next year. So Clayton dropped, and he may have gone sixth to Detroit, but he fell to seventh, and he was the first high school pitcher or player selected in that draft. But right from the get-go, you saw that he had extreme talent. You know, the delivery had a little stop and start to it, which it still does, but you knew that you were looking at somebody that had a not just the ability, but he still has this competitiveness that is just sometimes maybe to his detriment, because sometimes when he gets into trouble, it's, you know, he's going to try harder and harder and harder instead of softer and softer and softer. But right from the get-go, he was special. And I remember bringing him to spring training the next year in 09 or in 07. And I think it was 07. And we were playing the Red Sox in Vero Beach. And I had told Joe, I said, we're going to bring over the kid and you get to see him for an inning. And I told Rick Honeycutt, I says, it's only an inning. Don't fall in love here. It's only going to be an inning. And he may have faced Big Poppy in that inning, but, you know, he pitched well. I mean, he was a kid. He was 18, 19 years old. And from that moment on, it was like, when do we get to see this guy again? I think this may have been the next year. This may have been 08. I don't think it was that very next spring, but it was very quick in his development. And, you know, Terry Collins was our player development guy at that time. So, you know, the former manager of the Mets was really the person that, along with our pitching coaches down in Vero Beach and then up the ladder a little bit, was the people who had the first look at him on a daily basis.
Wow. Well, and you know, you'll be there, I'm sure, on the day when he's inducted to the Hall of Fame and makes that make a speech. Last one, I was curious. You know, one of the players that you can't take eyes off of, Yasiel Puig. And I remember talking to you about him one of the first times that you saw him, and you were just amazed by just that simple fact that you couldn't take your eyes off him.
No, sometimes good, sometimes bad, you know. The base running, sometimes you wanted to take your eyes off him. But I can't remember a player who came up and drew the attention of the sports world and the baseball world like he did. And our plan was really to give him as much of a full year in Double A as possible. We assigned him in June, I think, of 12, and he spent the rest of that season in the rookie league in Arizona and then a little bit in Rancho Cucamonga High A, went to winter ball, and then had a great spring, and then we sent him to Double A Chattanooga because as talented as he is still, he had rough edges to his game. And we needed to really, at the big league level, you know, it's tough to smooth stuff out when you get to that level because the game is so quick. And so we kept him down there as long as we could keep him down there. And I think we had injuries to Matt and Carl Crawford almost on the same weekend in Colorado. I don't have my dates maybe completely correct, but I lost two outfielders and I had no choice. And not that it was a bad choice, but I had hoped that every day there was a chance he would get a little bit smoother with what he needed to kind of smooth out. And he came up, and the first game he played in right field against San Diego, and the game ended with him doubling up a runner on first base to end the game. Dave Roberts happened to be the Padres' first base coach that night. And whenever I look at that video, I look at the face as the game ends, because it ends on this fly out to right field and then this bullet to first base to double him off. And I look at the face of Andre Ething in from center field. Now, here's an accomplished big league player, and the look on his face was, wow. And that's where it continued. And he hit great. He played great. He brought enthusiasm to it. He played with tremendous passion. You know, he was late once in a while, which rubbed people the wrong way. He wasn't the most pliable player to coach. But as time went on, I thought his last year or two with L.A., he really became a better hitter where he became more patient. Because as good as he was in the postseason and in the regular season, when we did get to the postseason in 13 and then in 14, you know, good pitching could take him to school a little bit. And I think, you know, that's something that good pitching can take a lot of people to school. But, you know, he was somebody that I'll never forget, his exuberance to play and his love for the game. But, again, not completely smooth. You know, he's a player I'll never forget for a lot of reasons, including some of the base running. You know, ran into a triple play. And it was like,
right,
what are we doing?
How did you deal with that? You mentioned about the sometimes late. You were being polite. that part of it, how did you deal with that as executive? Because on one hand, there are probably times you watched him during the game go, wow, and then you'd hear about, you know, an absence or being late or whatever it was, and you'd also be like, wow. How did you deal with that?
I probably had more meetings with him one-on-one than any other player in my career, certainly in my Dodger career, easily. And it was always in this manner that, hey, look, you can't do this. This isn't how we're going to do it. And don't force me to do something you really don't want me to do. So clean it up, okay? And he thought people were picking on him a little bit, and he had excuses from time to time. You know, I had to manage that and do that. If you remember, there was a there was an incident in the off season in Florida where he was caught speeding, I think maybe in the Everglades,
right,
at 110, 115 miles an hour, I think with his mom in the car, no less. And, I had just seen him at the stadium like a week earlier where, you know, my office sat overlooking the field and it was middle of winter and the lights were on. It's like 6 o'clock at night. You know, the sun sets at 5 o'clock. It's 6 o'clock at night and there's all these kids on the field. And it's Yasiel with all these kids. And he just would bring kids to the ballpark and, talk to community relations about turning the lights on. And he'd play ball with 8, 9, 10. He had this great love and affection for kids like that. And then a week or 2 weeks later, he's driving through the Everglades like he's in the Indy 500, you know. And I said, Yasi, what are you doing? And I said, you can't be doing this. I said, what happens if you kill yourself? What happens if you kill somebody else? What are you going to tell these kids if you end up, you know, doing some damage to somebody? I says, you got to think about what you do. He told me something really interesting at the end of his first year with us, because I had, him meet with Kobe Bryant. God bless him. I had him meet with Kobe, who obviously was a star in L.A. And I says, Yasiel, you know, you don't know what your future holds, but, you know, you may have an opportunity to be an iconic player because you certainly have the talent. And so I had put some people in his life that I thought could kind of show him from a player-to-player standpoint what you need to do and how you need to do it. And at the end of the season, I had meetings with all our young players, kind of an exit interview. And I said, look, you played great. You came up here. You really did a lot of good stuff. But I need you to think about the decisions you make on the field, off the field, late at night. I need you to think about those decisions because, you know, we can't have nothing bad happen to you. And you don't want nothing bad happen to you either. And he looked at me and he says, Poppy, and he says, so I always call you Poppy, I got to tell you something. He says, where I grow up, we don't worry about tomorrow. And I always had to keep that in mind. That here's a kid that grew up in Cuba, grew up in a different environment, a different culture, different situations. Authority to him was probably viewed differently than authority to somebody who grew up in Pasadena. And you know, it was something that I had to always keep in mind with every player, that the day I met them wasn't the first day their life started, that there was a lot of things that had gone on in everybody's life, including my own, that when you first meet somebody, you have to take that into effect. And so I had to be patient with them, too. I couldn't let them overstep the boundaries of what was right and wrong. But I had to be patient, and our manager and our coaching staff had to be patient, knowing, you know, he's not from Pasadena or Manhattan Beach and grew up a Dodger fan and played at UCLA or Fullerton or Pepperdine and was a number one pick, and a year later is in the big leagues. That young player might have challenges, too, being 21 years old and the king of the city athletically. So, you know, we needed to take that into consideration because how he grew up, we didn't exactly know, but we knew it was different. At the same time, we had to walk the line because we couldn't let him break the rule or rules at the same time. So it was a situation that was unique to many of us in that we really had to pay attention to where he came from and what his view of the world was. Because when you're 21 years old and you go from living in that type of society that he came out of, and suddenly you sign for $42 million. And a year later, you're in L.A. and you're playing for the Dodgers. Think about how fast that life went. Because it was about 12 months from when he signed to when he came to the big leagues. Anybody coming from point A, which is where he was as a kid, to point B in Dodger Stadium, let's say 12 or 18 months later, that's fast. And there's going to be a lot of adjustment to that. And we had to keep that in mind always while we had other players, too, that needed to be respected and rules needed to be respected from our managers. And so it was a juggling act many times, but somebody that I've always liked a lot and somebody who I had many conversations with, heartfelt type of conversations, and many of them ended up in tears. When he called me from Florida that day, I mean, he was in tears, begging me for forgiveness that he knew he made a mistake. Kind of an interesting personality, but a mercurial player there for a while, no doubt.
Yeah, 45 seconds left, and I'm curious, and this is just to follow up on that. How was it that you arranged for Kobe to talk, I'm guessing through Magic Johnson, or maybe you knew Kobe yourself, and what do you remember about hearing what Kobe told him?
Well, he told him that, you know, you're here. People like you, and people are amazed at your athleticism and your ability to play for the Dodgers. That's your calling card. Don't ever sacrifice. Don't ever let anything sacrifice that. That is really the primary thing. If you just came here from Cuba and you were an accountant, nobody'd really care. But you are a Los Angeles Dodger like I'm a Los Angeles Laker. And there's a certain aura that goes with that and a certain responsibility that goes with that. And you can never let anything detract from the reason that you're really here and the first reason people fell in love with you.
Wow. He was, I mean, if anybody was going to know, it was going to be Kobe Bryant. Ned, I love hearing your stories. I've always enjoyed talking with you through the years because you have such a great anecdotal memory. And I don't be surprised if we go longer here without baseball, I might be tapping on your shoulder again.
Well, I'm very busy these days, Buster, but I'm free usually Monday through Sunday about 8 a.m. till 1 a.m. So if I'm working in, I will. Pleasure to talk to you.
Here's Tim Kirchens, Daily Baseball Fix about Omar Vizquel.
On this date in 1967, Omar Vizquel was born. After Ozzie Smith, he's the greatest defensive shortstop I've ever seen, and he has the greatest hands of all time. So in January 1998, I went to do a story on those hands. I brought my glove with me like I was 7 years old. It was pathetic. But I needed to see him do this sleight of hand thing where it never appears like the ball ever enters his glove, and now it's back in his hand and he's throwing it again. So I played catch with him in the rain, 50 degrees on his driveway in Seattle. 50 throws. He did the sleight of hand thing every time. I said, Omar, I can't see what you're doing. Show me what you're doing. Here's what he did. He deflected the ball off the heel of his glove, caught it here, and threw it back to me. 50 throws. Not one of them went into the pocket of his glove. And I looked at him and I said, Omar, how can you do that? And he said, oh, that's magic.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Friday, last batch of the week. First up, we got Debbie Gammons Brown asking, since it's GM week on the podcast, what do you think the biggest difference is between the Brad Pitt movie Billy Bean and the real Billy Bean?
The real Billy Bean had Hudson, Zito, and Mulder pitching for him. In the movie Moneyball, those three guys were never mentioned. And I think if you talk to anybody about the A's of that time, they would say those three were probably the backbone of their success. What do you think, Taylor?
Kind of important. Although I'll admit I made a graphic the other day with Billy Bean in it, and I wasn't really sure what he looked like. Doesn't quite have the looks that Brad Pitt does, but, you know, handsome gentleman in his own right, for sure. Next up, Thomas Kennedy at game 686. He writes in, listened to the interview with Randy Johnson, forgot Council was part of the winning rally against Rivera in Game 7 of 01. Council was also part of the winning rally in Game 7 of 97. What other unlikely heroes have been part of multiple big rallies like that?
Just a quick follow on the comment you made about Brad Pitt. Let's face it, if Brad Pitt's playing anybody, you're going to feel like it's a downgrade, right? From the actual real person. The second thing is, when my brother and I did a charity event after a hurricane blew through Vermont, we did a charity event for Vermont farmers. And maybe the coolest item we got, and thanks to Billy Bean for this, was an Oakland Athletics jersey signed by both Billy and Brad Pitt. That was a lot of fun. It was very a cool thing that he did. To answer that question, big rallies like that. I can't think of anybody else when you're talking about that absolute biggest moment like those two were, you know, where a team actually walks off Game 7 in 97, Craig Council scoring the winning run there, and the Council being a part of one of the most memorable moments in baseball history in 2001. There's, for me, nothing comparable to that.
Good pull, Thomas. Last one for today, Chris Schmidt at CSchmidt0129 writes in, hey Buster, Tim Kirchin's talk about baseball box scores got me thinking about keeping score. What scorebook do you guys get or use? I still keep score at games I go to, and I hate the books I have found, so I made my own scorecard and book. Interesting.
Next time we have Tim on, Chris, I'll ask him because I do Sunday Night Baseball and I'm a sideline reporter, a lot of times I wind up getting rained on, so I don't even bother you getting like a good scorebook because it would just get completely wiped out and ruined. So I actually just have a regular old reporter notebook and draw in lines myself and write in names and create my own scorecard for the games that I do, because I just assume at some point it's just going to get wiped out. So I don't have any. I don't have a good source. I know Tim well enough to know he does have one, and we'll ask him the next time he comes on.
It's a lock. Tim has a good one. That is it. Yep. For Bleacher Tweets for the week. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. And real quick, Buster, what did you think of the Vikings draft last night? You got a wide receiver. You got a corner. Two picks in the first round. I thought it was a decent haul for them.
I did. And they swapped out of that spot, number 25, with San Francisco 49ers. They got an extra fourth round pick. They needed a cornerback because they moved on from Xavier Rhodes. And I like the fact they got a wide receiver to help begin to fill in a gap for Stephon Diggs.
Good stuff.
That's it for today. That's it for this week. My thanks today to Ned Coletti, to Todd Radom, and to Taylor Schwenk. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.